Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. Think beyond the traditional to the transformational. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk with me, Vincent Wall. This is where we take a wider view of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with me by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Lorenzo Codogno. He's visiting professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science, founder and chief economist of LC Macro Advisors, and former chief economist and director general at the Treasury Department of the Italian Ministry of Economy and Finance. Lorenzo, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Lorenzo, we have talked in happier times, I suppose, about the Italian economy and its challenges. But first and foremost, what's happening in Italy is a desperate human tragedy. I don't know what part of Italy you're from, but I assume you have extended family and friends and neighbours back home. And it must be almost impossible for people there to, apart from survival and feeding their families, to think of the wider economy now.
Yeah, it is effectively a disaster from a humanitarian point of view. I mean, the death toll is massive. Having said that, clearly we have to move on and let's hope that this situation doesn't last for long.
Is there any hope at all there at the moment, just in terms perhaps of the rate of infection seems to be slowing?
Yeah, over the past few days, there seems to be some kind of slowdown in the recorded cases. Although I have to say that the uncertainty is very high as for the statistics, because some people say that the true number of affected people might be 10 times as much as the one found positive to the test. Also, in terms of the death toll, many are basically dying without being recorded as affected by the virus. And therefore, I think only after the fact that we will see whether the number of deaths over the past couple of months will be much higher than last year. I think that will be the final count. So again, a lot of uncertainty about the statistics at this stage. But having said that, according to the official numbers, it looks like there is some slowdown over the past few days, which seems to be encouraging. Indeed, given the lockdown of many areas, we should be at a turning point. And I think it's about time to see some slowdown. Doesn't mean that the situation is improving, because the number of people affected continue to rise, but they continue to rise at a slower pace now, which is good.
I suppose we've talked before about the cynicism of some Italians about their governments and about the rapidly changing nature of some governments, and that's led to a surge in populism in Italy. But there seems to be strong support for the leadership of Giuseppe Conte as prime minister, a technocrat who only became prime minister almost by default 2 years ago.
Yes, you are right. I mean, the country is effectively at war, okay? And when you are at war, you try to close ranks and to be united, okay? Which is what is happening in Italy right now. Even the opposition now is trying to adopt a constructive attitude and try to support the government with the proposals, which is a positive attitude, I would say. Conte, I would say, the government and especially the prime minister, I think made some mistakes at the beginning. There was some confusion. But now they are up to speed, and I would say people tend to appreciate what they are doing at the moment. So there seems to be support for what the government is doing. I think it's a necessary decision to close down a big chunk of the country in order to preserve lives.
In terms of Italy's attitude to the wider European community. There has been strained relationships going back over well over a decade. Firstly, in response to the financial crash, then the whole immigrant crisis, people landing on Italy's shores and the Italians feeling they were on their own, that there must now be even more of a sense of abandonment from the rest of Europe in terms of the initial response, at least, to this crisis that Italy has been going through.
Yeah, you're right. The initial response was very disappointing, both from the fiscal side in Europe and the monetary side. But the monetary side has changed quite a lot over the past few days. And as you know, eventually the ECB came out with a big bazooka and a substantial, actually, program to buy assets. So I think the monetary side has already done what could have decided to do. And so it's really appreciated right now. On the fiscal side, it's the general perception is that it's still every man for himself, so to speak. So in other words, there isn't much solidarity at European level. And but we will see. I think it's absolutely essential that Europe provides a convincing response in this situation, because as you mentioned, there are nationalistic instincts and anti-European tensions that at the moment are muted, but once the crisis is over and the economic damage becomes apparent, it might actually resurface and might actually produce some problems, political and social problems in Italy versus the rest of Europe. And this is not just an isolated situation. I think throughout Europe, if Europe does not provide concrete answers to European citizens, that might eventually become a problem.
We'll talk about the possible further fiscal help that might be available in a minute, Lorenzo. But even at a human level, do the Italians feel slightly abandoned in the sense that the Germans initially refused to send medical help to them and kept it at home? Now they changed that, but there was that initial refusal. And I saw the Dutch finance minister, Wopke Hoekstra, basically asking Brussels to investigate whether economies like Italy should have done more in the past to be prepared for a crisis like this. Something that somebody said was a middle finger to Italy and Southern Europe generally.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that the attitude has been a little bit mixed throughout Europe. Having said that, I mean, there are also areas and countries that are very much supportive of the current situation. I think to some extent it is understandable because Italy is in the first line. The second line will be the other countries. Basically, other countries are now severely affected. Spain is second, but also the virus is spreading in other areas. So clearly other countries are very much concerned that the situation might worsen quite sharply in their countries, and therefore are somewhat reluctant to provide help in terms of medical equipment and stuff. So Italy had no choice but to ask to Russia, to China and others, which were quite quick to provide some help. I think, again, you need to find ways at European level to give concrete signals to citizens, to show that Europe is behind and is really supportive. So I think it's not yet over. I think we will see how the European Council will end up. We will see whether there will be a possibility for European leaders to come up with solutions, and whether this becomes an opportunity for Europe to move on and strengthen integration under the emergency. I think that would be the positive solution. The alternative clearly would be a disaster. In other words, it would be a further division within countries and accusations. So I think there's still a chance. The outcome is still very much open at this stage, I would say.
Despite the current opposition of the Germans and the Dutch, amongst others, do you think that the least the Italians and other countries that are going through the worst of this require is a shared euro bond, a mutualization of the risk? Or does Italy need almost a Marshall Plan type emergency rescue like after the Second World War?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, as you have seen, nine Eurozone countries signed a letter to the President of the European Council supporting the introduction of Eurobonds, and including Ireland, by the way. And this is quite a big chunk of the Eurozone. It accounts for 56% of Eurozone GDP, so it's something that cannot be easily dismissed. And so we will see whether this will produce a result at the level of the European Council. I personally believe that some centralized fiscal capacity and Eurobonds are absolutely essential to make sure that the Eurozone is able to respond to economic shocks, future economic shocks, including the current one, and also be able to kind of become more resilient. I think, however, that politically it's still pretty toxic to go for that. So it would be essential at least to introduce the minimum tools that are necessary to respond to this crisis and maybe start the process afterwards to address the issue over time in a situation that hopefully will not be as an emergency situation, but again, more time to think about the situation and how to better respond to this kind of crisis in the future. For now, I think the real important issue is to make sure that one way or the other, European institutions are able to respond in a proper way and immediately.
And if that support comes, if that stimulus comes over time, what are the threats to the Italian economy in the short and medium term? Obviously, the banks are still very fragile and could even become more so if a lot of businesses and households renege on their debts. And then I presume there will be, it will take a long time for any sort of confidence to come back into the economy generally.
I have a mixed feeling because, it is true that probably the recovery won't be very quick because we can expect people to be a bit reluctant to start spending again or companies to start investing again. And then it will take a while for the whole economy to go to back on track. But at the same time, you have to consider that this is purely a temporary shock. Related to non-economic matters. So if the policy response is correct, we could also envisage a situation in which the economy bounces back rather quickly and the loss, especially on the supply side of the economy, remains rather contained. So I think the jury is still out how permanent, how deep will be the damage to the economy. There is still a chance, again, with policy, correct policy responses to bring the economy back on track quite quickly.
Well, let's hope that happens, and let's hope from a human point of view that that we are through the peak of what's happening in your home country now. But we'll leave it there. Lorenzo Codogno, visiting professor of the London School of Economics and Political Science, founder and chief economist of LC Macro Advisors, and former chief economist and director general at the Treasury Department of the Italian Ministry of Economy and Finance. Lorenzo, stay safe and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think beyond the traditional to the transformational. PwC.ie.
We're joined now by Dr. Yu Jie, Senior Research Fellow on China, Chatham House in London. Dr. Yu, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you and others have written recently that China is trying to turn what was and still is, I suppose, an extreme public health crisis into a geopolitical opportunity, which I'd like to explore with you in just a few moments. But you might just remind us how strained relations between the Chinese government, the Communist ruling party, and those most affected in the state of Hubei and Wuhan, its capital, were only 2 or 3 months ago.
Yes, I mean, it was unexpected turn. Obviously, the early reticence of the local government from Hubei tried to cover up the entire situation. And this really gave a really bad taste for the entire Chinese population. But I wonder, you know, this is a country 17 years ago had a SARS crisis, and why are we having this again? So I think that at that very time, the Chinese Communist Party's leadership is really caught its legitimacy in jeopardy. So obviously, the senior leadership in Beijing took this very seriously and realized that simply there's no way they cannot cover up the entire public health crisis. And therefore, the best way is to have a very heavy state intervention to control the disease. So that's the after 2.5 months now, and here we are. And China seems to be on a positive direction for the moment.
Thankfully, from a public health and human point of view, in what way was that legitimacy called into question of the ruling Communist Party? Was it principally online? I mean, there was no social disorder on the streets.
Well, there's no social disorder on the street, and obviously because the entire country was a lockdown, so there's no way people can vent the anger except by using online platform. And obviously, within the online platform, and especially given the death of that whistleblower doctor, the entire public anxiety just been uproar. I've never experienced somebody who's so apolitical and then turned the anger towards the central government and also towards the provincial governments in general. So that was a very critical moment, I would say, for the Chinese Communist Party, because they will have to take care of the public opinion. I mean, it may sound very rather ironic, you know, one party ruling country, and the one party doesn't do care about public opinion. But I'm afraid, and this Communist Party will have to take care of the public opinion very seriously.
In what way did the party at the highest level move to try to restore public opinion, apart from the actual fairly extreme and autocratic measures to lock down various populations? Did they actually remove some local officials?
Oh, yes, they did. They did sack both the party secretary of the province and also the governor of the province. So both at the party level and also at the government level, and the two people got fired and replaced somebody who is extremely capable and then dealing with the crisis. And of course, there's a very heavy-handed intervention. It has done it in a very classical Chinese way.
Now, we saw images recently of President Xi Jinping visiting Wuhan and waving to people still locked in their apartments. But obviously and thankfully, the situation seems to be improving markedly in China at both a human level and also the economy beginning to pick up. And as we referenced at the start, China now basically using that recovery to spread its soft power across the globe and say, look, we've actually tackled this in the right way. Autocracy was required. You Western democracies can't do the same thing.
Well, I think what we have to admit in here is the viruses pay no attention to democracy or autocracy, and they only do thrive on confusion. And that's the way. So I think this for China, if they want to run that narrative by saying, look, we are the only legitimate way of dealing with global pandemic, and I think that's a not very successful narrative. But instead, and what China could do, if they could do it very wisely, is just by offering the medical help, as what China is doing right now, to give this medical help for over 83 countries, and try to tone down this ideological element within it.
We've seen them doing that. We've seen the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, calling China his brothers and looking for help which has come. We saw a phone call directly to the Italian prime minister last week, Giuseppe Conte, offering, and Italy has fostered economic links with China through the Belt and Road partnership. Is that purely humanitarian on the Chinese government's part, or is there a political propaganda element is involved as well, particularly with United States not showing global leadership at the moment?
I think there's a combination of three things on what China is doing right now. Firstly, obviously, there were certain countries helped China during the time of the China's pandemic 2 months ago. So it's a way of China give back to those countries. And secondly, more importantly, is the element which you touched is obviously all those countries China helped is the country remain a relatively good terms with China in the past. So again, China is launching a soft power campaign. But also more importantly is because the global pandemic, so the weaker economy in the Eurozone and also the weaker economy at a global level would do China much more harm than anything else. So China has no any other option apart from helping certain countries to get over with this crisis. And if we're examining those countries very carefully, and these are the countries, China, which has paid key attention on the Belt and Road Initiative, so countries you mentioned, Italy, countries like Pakistan, countries like Serbia. So China does it for its own economic benefit as well.
Is it also sending a message to the United States, quite an aggressive message, because we know the trade tensions that have been there for some time. We've seen the expulsion of journalists on both sides, almost as bad as things were back in the late 1980s at the time of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Is this an aggressive message to the United States as well, that China is now a real world leader in terms of its humanitarian policy as well?
I think it is an aggressive message. But obviously, this aggressive message has not also been received very well inside China as well. I mean, if you have noticed that the recent debate among the Chinese diplomats, so you have the Chinese ambassador in the United States, and openly said he paid no attention to what a foreign ministry speaker person has said. So obviously, there's also internal debate within China itself. How should China casting its international image? So that's one thing. And the second thing is, it's this whole idea of China would be able to projecting its global leadership and the global governance. So I felt this is nothing new. Since President Xi Jinping came to power back to 2012, and he put forward this idea of the so-called discursive power, which means China will be able to shape the international agenda from the very beginning of the international debate. And I think what China has been doing now in terms of dealing with this global pandemic, it is a way of casting that discursive power.
How much of this is actually targeted at China's own people as well? I think we're getting close to a very important anniversary, and also to show after what have been acknowledged as significant mistakes at the early start of the epidemic, that they are now, there's a confidence back, not just at home, but abroad as well.
It is. They will have to deal with that repercussion. So what the Chinese government is trying to do now is to restore the public faith that the government has the capability of handling the crisis. But they also want to send back to its domestic audience a positive and a powerful narrative that China is indeed the global leader when it comes to dealing with public health crises. So this is certainly a very strong domestic element for that.
And next year is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yes, indeed. So as the centenary of the Chinese Communist Party is coming up, and I think the priority really for China until July next year is how to make sure it could revive its economy at the right shape. Because, I mean, in the past 3 months, the economy was in standstill. And given the current likelihood of global economic recession, and how China will be able to maintain that reasonable growth and to make sure, firstly, everyone has a job, and secondly, everyone has a shelter. So these are two key things. And Xi Jinping will have to give to his own population to claim itself as being the legitimate leader. The party is the legitimate ruling party to run the country in the next 50 years or so.
Do you think the Chinese authorities have yet begun to think of the longer-term structural changes that might emerge globally because of what's happened? We see the United States, 97% of the antibiotics produced for the US market are manufactured in China. We see the French Prime Minister Bruno Le Maire basically saying that Europe is going to have to take back many of the strategic products now created in China back to Europe so that we're prepared for an emergency or a crisis in the future, that there may not be the same comfort in the West to have so many goods produced in China from now on.
Yes, I agree. I entirely agree with this. I mean, obviously, the global supply chain will be disrupted. And I think the other key lesson which the Chinese decision maker should have learned from this crisis is, at the end of the day, if we are talking about China's economic miracle, the double-digit growth in the past 20 years or so, it's the economic growth by building the hard infrastructure of the airports and railways and the high-speed railway. And none of this would be easily translated into public health. So So what we're talking about, the soft infrastructure. So I think to go forward, the Chinese government will have to learn the mistakes that it is not sustainable to have a country with 1.4 billion population, but only more than 30,000 hospitals to dealing with public health. This is just not sufficient. So I'm expecting to see more and more public health awareness happen at the senior leadership level as well.
But by and large, you think as China emerges from this crisis, most of its population is broadly happy with the way the authorities manage the situation in the end?
I think the most of the population will be quite happy because this is over, this is nearly over by now. But the bigger question what we ask is, firstly, if we are talking about effective national governance and why the local authority has a strong incentive to cover up, and secondly, if we are talking about this is a party for the people, and then where are people going to looking for its doctors when they come to a public health crisis like this? So where's resilience of dealing with the global pandemic come from China? And I think that's the key question. The population will question its leadership.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Dr. Yu Zhi, Senior Research Fellow on China, Chatham House, London. Dr. Yu, stay safe and thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Taking Stock on Newstalk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think beyond the traditional to the transformational. PwC.ie.
We're joined now by Sir Angus Deaton, Nobel Prize-winning economist and co-author of Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. Angus, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've all been plunged into a world where a global pandemic continues to spread with still open-ended and very grim human and economic effects. But you and your co-author, Anne Case, have written here in this book about the causes and effects of, I suppose, a stealthier, more insidious, multi-decade plague that has killed hundreds of thousands of Americans needlessly. What are these deaths of despair and why have they happened?
Well, that's a big question, but let me define them first. We noticed that about 5 years ago when we first started studying this, that mortality rates were going up from suicides, from alcoholic liver disease, and from drug overdoses. And it's those three causes that together we labeled deaths of despair. So it was just a convenient label. We think of suicide as the archetypal death of despair, but these are deaths that are all to some extent caused by your own hand. And so we thought the deaths of despair label would be a good label for those. The causes are controversial, but we think that what has happened is a very long-term, slow-rolling disaster for America's white working class. A lot of it is the familiar forces around the world of globalization and technical change. But a lot of it is this sort of self-inflicted wound in America, in which we have a healthcare service that costs an enormous amount of money, and much of which is paid for out of worker salaries. And at the bottom, that becomes sort of impossible. So a lot of jobs have gone away. A lot of jobs are not the good jobs they were. They've been replaced by outsourced jobs or by jobs that don't really have any future or gig jobs. And this has a slow-moving, disastrous effect on communities, on marriages, on the levels of pain people are feeling, and just a lot of bad stuff going on at the same time.
Now, the United States, almost exclusively in the Western world, has seen its mortality rates rise and its life expectancy actually begin to fall, but these deaths of despair, which to some degree are responsible for those pretty grim trends, are affecting non-Hispanic, white, midlife people in particular.
Right. And why is that? Well, part of it is that African Americans went through their own crisis about 50 years ago. And in some sense, what you're seeing is, or one interpretation of this, is that jobs first shed the least skilled workers who were the less educated Black Americans, and then they've now come for the less educated white Americans. And these deaths of despair are almost exclusively among people who don't have a four-year university degree. The Hispanics, it's difficult to tell because there's no, the fact that they all speak Spanish doesn't really make them a homogeneous group. So we don't really have very much to say about that. But they have a very different community structure. Many of them were recent immigrants or second-generation immigrants. And so it's not so surprising that they're doing okay.
Why do you think? Because we know that the impact of globalization and the downsizing and outsourcing of traditional blue-collar jobs has happened in many Western economies. Why do you think this has been a particularly American phenomenon?
Well, first of all, it's not entirely American. There have been much smaller epidemics of the same kind in other countries, particularly in Britain, to some extent in Ireland and Canada and Australia, for instance. So English-speaking countries have seen some of this, not as much as we've seen in America by any manner of means. But there are really two things in America that make it particularly difficult. One is that we basically license the pharmaceutical companies to sell legalized heroin in the form of OxyContin and other very strong opioid painkillers. That unleashed an epidemic of overdose deaths, and there's no such epidemic in European countries or in Canada where they just didn't let this happen. So OxyContin, for instance, is used in Ireland and England, elsewhere, say when you've had a hip replacement or you've had serious surgery, but no one sends you home with a bottle of 40 pills, which is what was happening here. And here, when the doctors pulled back, the illegal drug dealers selling heroin and fentanyl were just waiting at the doors of the clinic, ready to ignite what was essentially a secondary epidemic. The other thing is what I said at the beginning, that the healthcare system here is twice as expensive as most other countries, and we're wasting billions of dollars. And much of that is coming out of worse jobs for people. It's really poisoning the labor market. So that's really one of the reasons we think it's a peculiarly American, or at least much worse in America than it is in other countries.
And yet you also write in the book that the opioid, the pain-killing epidemic that you described there, and the actions of the medical profession in general in stimulating that and fanning it, really was just very strong petrol on a flame that had already started perhaps back in the 70s with the breakdown of traditional working class blue collar working and social structures generally.
I think that's right. And, you know, there's if you read the accounts of how pharma companies operated, especially Purdue Pharmaceutical, which is owned by the Sackler family, they targeted places where they knew there was likely to be despair. So, you know, they went to places where there used to be coal mines and there are no coal mines anymore. They went to places where there were no jobs and people had lost jobs and factories had moved out. And they, worked very hard to get doctors to prescribe painkillers in those communities. And, you know, I think a lot of that pain was associated with the long-term deterioration of the economic structure in those places, as well as physical pain, because there's been a huge rise in pain experienced in middle age in America in a way that's just not true.
You referenced there how some elements of the medical profession, the pharma companies, targeted communities that were beginning to suffer from despair in any case. But we are all aware of the term the Rust Belt now, but the United States is not the only place that has these Rust Belts, industrial cities that have long seen their best and are past their prime. But I suppose there is another element to American life in that it doesn't have either the safety nets at federal or state or local level, the social security safety nets that are prevalent elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's correct. The safety net is much weaker here than it is elsewhere. It's not entirely non-existent, but it tends to be very weak. It's also true that other countries didn't allow pharma companies to peddle heroin in their Rust Belt, and that made a big difference.
To what degree is the drop in median wages in the United States, which is far more severe and sharp than elsewhere in the Western world, a cause as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the median wages for people without a BA, which is the group we're really talking about here, those have been declining for the more than 50 years now. Until the virus came along, they were rising quite nicely, but they were still lower than they'd been at any date in the 80s. So So it's just very, very long-term trend of declining wages. We put a lot of the blame for that on the rising cost of healthcare. There's an enormous increase in the cost. And instead of that people going into people's wage packet, it's going into paying for, you know, these pharmaceuticals. It's paying for ever more expensive hospitals. It's paying for very expensive doctors in many cases. Not all doctors, but a lot of doctors are very well paid. And indeed, the largest single occupational group in the top 1% is doctors.
You're incredibly critical in the book of the healthcare system in the United States generally, not just because it's sucking that income, I suppose, that might go to workers in other situations, but also it's incredibly powerful lobby in Washington influencing the politicians. You say the sheriff of Nottingham is alive and well in Washington, and huge monopolistic profits.
All those things, you got it right. I mean, but it's just, you know, there are five healthcare lobbyists in Washington for every member of Congress. Just think about that. It's an extraordinary number. And they write their own bills and write their own checks. And so they're completely out of control. And it's going to take some terrible event, some revolution. Maybe it'll take a pandemic to get this reformed.
We might come to that in a minute, but 18% of GDP going into healthcare in the United States, and yet some of the worst outcomes in the Western world for that. Is that because it is privatized? Because there are no price controls? It's effectively a free market system?
Well, it's not effectively a free market system. You know, I mean, obviously it's free market compared with what other countries have, where the government interferes much more. But, you know, if this were a free market, it's not like, you know, free markets are like grocery stores or car dealerships or something. And they don't get huge subsidies from the government. They don't have all these lobbyists that are writing their own ticket. So it's really free market plus rent seeking that's really the curse here. And, you know, you cannot deliver good health care with a free market system. If you do, you know, we don't mind if people don't have TVs or they don't have a car or something. But we do mind if they don't get any health care and they die on the street. So government is always going to be interfered in this. And the difficulty in America is sort of pretending that we have a free market competitive health care system, when in fact what we have is a bunch of rich people seeking more money at people's expense from the government.
To what degree, and you referenced it briefly before, Angus, to what degree is the whole race issue a sort of malignant sauce as well in this American phenomenon, in the sense that hopefully, and it seems that there is much greater tolerance, racial tolerance generally in American society, but that I suppose these white working class, non-college educated people feel that they are suffering, relatively speaking, to what was the most oppressed group in U.S. society before that?
Yes, I think there's some truth to that. And I think, you know, there was a sense in which for less educated white people, they had some sort of white privilege, and it was the only privilege they had. And when you lose that, you know, what is really actually equalizing seems like oppression. And I think that has been very hard. There's also a sense that minorities are being favored in many cases, that people are jumping in line or jumping the line, and the people who've tried their best feel that a lot of other people are getting unfair advantages over them. So I'm sure that's part of it. It's also true that historically, one of the reasons we don't have a better safety net here, and one of the reasons we don't have a state-run health system, is because of the problems of race, and that, you know, it was always blocked by political forces from the southern states.
We're talking about huge numbers of people here. You reckon that if U.S. mortality rates and life expectancy rates had continued in a trend similar to other Western societies, say from the late 1990s on, 600,000 people that have died from these deaths of despair, suicide, alcoholism, liver disease, and opioid addiction, would still be alive or would have lived longer?
That's right. I mean, those sort of calculations are always, you know, they involve a hypothetical which can't be confirmed. Another important thing that's going on, which we do emphasize in the book, is that, you know, for a long time all through from about 1970 through the turn of the century, there was a huge decrease in deaths from heart disease. And that decrease is now happening much more slowly, and for some groups is even reversed. That's happening in Europe too. And the slowdown in the rate of increase in life expectancy is not purely an American phenomenon. It's just much fiercer here. But, you know, in England, for example, life expectancy has stagnated for about 5 or 6 years now. And there's a slowdown pretty much everywhere. So the American story is we got that slowdown and we got all this other bad stuff too. And that's killing a very large number of people.
What's to be done about all this, Angus? I mean, you write that you considered using the title the failure of capitalism rather than the future of capitalism, but you stuck with the future because you are ultimately a supporter of capitalism with all its faults. But where do you start? Do you need to educate more people? Do you need to rein in the drug companies? What's to be done?
I think we certainly need to rein in the drug companies, and we need to get a healthcare system that looks like other countries' healthcare systems. So those are sort of immediate priorities, I think. Education is much more difficult. I mean, I think there's been a stop in the increase in people getting BAs here. And some of that is because it's gotten much more expensive. And some of it is there's not as many places as there once were. Some of that is also due to healthcare because the states have to pay so much for healthcare. They're cutting back on their educational budgets. But something we do need, and I don't quite know how to do this, is a system that educates people not just to go to college and that fails for 2/3 of the people. That's not a good system. We need to educate people to a much wider range of skills, maybe more like the German system, which gives, you know, well-respected professions that don't have anything to do with going to college. I mean, you know, when I grew up in Scotland, you know, the people in our town that were most respected had never been to college, and they were in a really wide range of trades. You know, they were printers or motor salesmen or dentists or just all sorts of things. And some of them better trained than others. But, you know, there was no sense in which only the people who'd gone to college were really highly respected.
Do you think a significantly higher minimum wage across the United States or some other interventions in the payroll system in the United States might also help? Because you do write that the gap is widening between the incomes and, I suppose, the worldviews of those who have had a college education, a full college education, and those who don't, and that it's in the interests of those who have had a college education with their private pensions and all of that to keep those working at the coal front lower paid.
Yep. It is, because, you know, we all get rewarded through our stock portfolios, or we did until last week. The minimum wage, though, you know, we're in favor of increasing it, but the number of people on the federal minimum wage is not very large. And many states around the university have raised their minimum wage in recent years. We give some of those numbers in the book. But, you know, the minimum wage is small compared with what reducing healthcare costs would do to people's wages. So, you know, that's really the first priority.
Is anything likely to be done about this in the short term? Because I assume, perhaps naively, that a lot of the people and the families and the extended communities of these deaths of despair people are actually voters for Donald Trump or don't participate in the political system at all.
And one or the other of those, that would be very common. I mean, there are lots of ways of explaining who voted for Donald Trump. But it's certainly, you know, it correlates very well with the sort of things we're talking about. But, you know, my co-author Anne Case likes to say the 2016 election was the "Can you hear me now?" election. But, you know, a lot of these people don't vote. A lot of them feel the political system has nothing for them. And they're right, because the extraordinary degree of lobbying and so on in Washington doesn't mean that it's fixed. Because a lot of those lobbyists are fighting one another. But it does mean that ordinary people don't have any say in what goes on, and many Americans feel that. So, you know, maybe the pandemic that we have now will jolt people out of their complacency and bring change. The trouble is, change in the midst of a panic can go in the wrong direction as well as the right direction.
We've seen the executives of pharma companies now being brought to court for their actions, their criminal actions, and getting jail sentences. And I presume that will continue to unfold as those cases are examined. But do you think the current pandemic, with everything that it brings, will cause Americans generally to look at their health system, how much they're paying for it, what they're getting back from it, who delivers it?
It's very unpredictable. as I'm sure you know, as a journalist in this epidemic, but no one really knows what's going to happen. But, you know, the government has told people they'll get tested for free. What they have not promised is that anyone who needs treatment will get treatment for free. And there are stories going around now of people spending being billed $30,000 and $40,000 for COVID treatment that they, you know, and that when they recovered from the disease. I think if that goes on in any scale, there will be riots and revolution. I think it's also true if there's preventive medicine that works and people charge huge prices for it. There's a huge amount of anger against the pharma companies already, and I think that will boil over if that happens. So, you know, you don't wish a pandemic on anyone, but it would be great if some of those things got better.
And finally, if I may ask you, how has the current situation affected the community in which you live yourself?
Well, do we live in a community anymore? You know, we haven't been out for days. Well, we do. We go out for walks. But the community here is, you know, the grocery stores are open. The delivery things are working well. We see much more of our neighbors than we used to. But see is the operative word because we see them walking their dogs or going out for walks near where we live. And, you know, today is one of the most beautiful spring days you can imagine. So it's this very odd conjunction of the spectacularly beautiful spring with all these horrors going on outside.
Same on this side of the Atlantic, unfortunately. A grim story. Let's hope it doesn't last too long. Angus Deaton, Nobel Prize-winning economist and co-author of Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. Angus, stay well and thanks for joining us.
You too. Thank you very much.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think beyond the traditional to the transformational. PwC.ie.